This is Andrew Parrish, the original founder of Advisor Hub. I thought it would make sense to interview probably the foremost securities mind in the industry and probably the best transition specialist from a legal standpoint available to advisors right now, Brian Neville. I'm going to ask him several questions, walk through some of his commentary about what's happening across the industry right now, and even some of the rumors that are out there regarding potential protocol exits, new agreements that are finding their way to advisors now and towards the end of the year. But let's listen to what Brian has to say about all those issues.
Hey, how you doing, Brian?
I'm doing great.
Good. Great to reconnect. I know you and I sat down with each other several years ago in New York City and shared a meal.
It was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. It was a good 5-6 years ago. But here we are. We've come full circle, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. So thanks for taking the time. We thought that it would make some sense to get some thoughts from an expert in the field as it relates to navigating the legalities and paperwork that advisors oftentimes are faced with at a moment's notice and are asked to provide signatures for that, frankly, can affect the next 1 year, 3 year, 5 years, 10 years of their career. I'm reminded, I was on a phone call yesterday with a Merrill team, a gentleman that had about 3 to 5 years left and was contemplating their CPT program. And he made a passing reference to, you know, the truth of the matter is, you know, my partner's great. He's 46 years old, but, you know, we're trying to give some thought to if I, you know, if I go ahead and sign up for the CPT program, which may be good for me, it may not necessarily be good for him. And so in a lot of ways, we'd like to broadly kind of talk about the truth of that, conversation, as well as, get down to a little bit of nitty gritty as to what it looks like to extricate oneself from either having to sign that stuff or once they have, you know, what do those things look like? So, I'd like you to broadly quickly discuss, what you hear and see from Merrill advisors that you've serviced over the past 1 to 5 years, and what have you come across in terms of the legalities of how they've left the firm and at times what they've been faced with?
Sure, I'm happy to. I would say that, you know, I've represented financial advisors leaving and joining Merrill for the last 20 years. And the big change, of course, occurred when Bank of America took them over and after the credit crisis. But what I've seen more recently is just a more rapid deterioration of what had always been referred to as, you know, the Mother Merrill culture, and folks who have left, and when they get to a firm that's run like a broker dealer, describe it as, you know, like a breath of fresh air, like Merrill used to be 20 years ago. And so advisors who have stayed and have seen all the changes that are contemplating leaving have in many instances signed different types of agreements that make their leaving more difficult. And, you know, some of those are things such as team agreements, referral or assigned account agreements, retirement agreements, such as the different iterations of the CTP agreements. And all those agreements have changed. And all the different iterations of those more recently contain restrictions on things like the broker protocol, referral and assigned account agreements now carve out certain accounts. CTP agreements that used to be much more easy for a receiving advisor to make a decision that the firm is no longer for them and maybe leave have now become substantially more restrictive in their ability to solicit accounts. There's repayment terms that seem to be almost punitive if you leave prior to the end of those agreements. And the culture around all those is this idea that, you know, Bank of America views the accounts as theirs and they want to retain them, much more so than I think ever in the history of that firm. And the litigation that has been filed by Bank of America in a review of the pleadings in those, you will see a increased enforcement of the restrictive covenants in these different agreements, seemingly trying to send a message to the advisors that are at the firm or others that might be thinking of leaving, that if you're thinking of leaving, we're gonna fight to keep your accounts, and we're gonna really fight to keep you from soliciting at least some subset of those accounts. And the firm Merrill Lynch, you know, was really one of the original signatories to the broker protocol. But I do think to a lot of market participants, a lot of the clients that I've represented in the last 2 or 3 years, one of their primary concerns is the increased chatter that Merrill Lynch, you know, could leave. And of course, you know, we all saw that Morgan Stanley and UBS left, and they did so with very little notice. And, you know, so that is a huge concern for advisors that have, you know, some very restrictive covenants in their various agreements with Merrill Lynch, that should Merrill decide to leave, they could be subject to massive litigation risk in a transition. So that is one of the things that I've been hearing quite a bit about.
Thanks for that. You know, what's interesting is the chatter remains, and the concern around, you know, a protocol exit and what may be, you know, slid in front of advisors is another version of, you know, let's find new ways to tie up accounts that weren't even direct referrals from the bank, but may have significant product entanglements with Bank of America and Merrill Lynch. So those are some things that we've heard, but I'd like to revert back to, you know, a point that you've made as it relates to litigation associated with a potential transition. What is some of the advice that you've given, not just necessarily Merrill Lynch advisors, but advisors at large when it comes to dealing with a transition? Have you defaulted to a point of view where let's just assume that everybody's not a part of the protocol? And so given some firms are in, some firms are out, you know, what kind of advice are you giving advisors from a multitude of firms when it comes to exiting their firm? What type of advice do you give as a, you know, as counsel?
I would say that I start with a hope that the team doesn't have to make a swift exit. They should take some time, and they should make preparations in a timeline that allows them to get good advice. And they should be getting good advice from lawyers. They should be getting good advice from recruiters. They should talk to a kind of whole host of different types of firms to see what's the right fit for them. And then I start out telling almost every advisor that first and foremost, you should start to transition all of your banking and credit card usage away from your firm, because brokerage firms are now using artificial intelligence-based surveillance programs to monitor employees' banking and credit card transactions. Mm-hmm. And you do not want to be seen paying an attorney that's known to be representing advisors. You need to keep that away from brokerage firms. And then the next step would be you should have available to you all of your existing agreements. And you should be able to ask for them in a normal course such that it doesn't raise a red flag, because your move is so far away that you have those available. And if you don't have them, again, you want to obtain counsel who would generally be able to understand from when you moved, and then just go into their forms bank and see what the format of your existing agreement is most likely like based upon when you signed it, so that you can understand all of the possible restriction on your post-resignation conduct, including all the restrictive covenants in these different employment agreements, team agreements, et cetera. And you want to review those with counsel, but also you want to review them with the potential firms that you're moving to, because the firms that you're moving to do not want to get caught up in litigation either. So you just want to take a review of where you're at. And then to the point of your question on, do you view all moves as non-protocol? And the short answer is no, not necessarily. It is a nuanced analysis. And the first example I could think of is, you know, if you're living in California and working in California, you have protections under the state law there that are going to be better for you than probably any other state. But there's increasingly state-based laws that place restrictions on some of these non-solicits that can be advantageous to advisors. And then also you want to look at the history between the respective firms, right? So we all know in the marketplace, there's just certain firms out there, and we could use some examples like Rockefeller or First Republic that have stepped up their recruiting in recent years, and they're members of the protocol, and they have approaches to recruiting and transitions that make moving there, if you're at a protocol firm, easier than to a non-protocol firm. But all those things need to be analyzed, and it also depends upon the nature of an advisor's book. I just had a client move, and they had a book of 40 households. And I have another advisor that's about to move, and it's on a significant team, and they probably have 1,000 households. Those two moves would have to be treated very differently in a protocol or non-protocol move. So I don't think we should be yet at the stage where we think of all moves as non-protocol, but I think advisors at certain firms, and Merrill Lynch would be one of them, where there's such chatter, need to be thinking ahead. One of the things that the protocol has in it is a notice period that's really as short as 2 weeks that any member will seek to provide. I think it's 10 or 14 days notice prior to their withdrawal. And if Merrill Lynch were to announce that they're withdrawing, I think any team that's there that has been in negotiations would need to be prepared to move as swiftly as is possible. And I think anyone at a firm like Merrill Lynch or any firm that's subject to chatter that they may leave the protocol, you need to have a plan B. And you should, even if it's something that you think is a year off, you should have advanced discussions with different firms and recruiters about, hey, what happens if my firm withdraws from the protocol? What are my options? That's a discussion we've been having with a lot of advisors.
A question that popped into my head while you were talking, that I think at times advisors may or may not understand the differences. They may understand the differences, but they may not understand the restrictive value associated with a non-solicit or a non-compete. If you can take a minute to kind of walk through what each of those means. The non-solicit seems to be pretty self-explanatory, but I'd like to know a legal mind's understanding of a non-compete as well.
Sure. And in private wealth management, you're not going to see that many non-competes. And they are rarer and rarer. What I think you will see more, Andrew, is garden leave and notice provisions. Yeah. And yeah. I do think that, to your point, a lot of advisors confuse non-competes, garden leaves, and non-solicits when they're all vastly different restrictive covenants. A non-compete literally says that you will not compete with that entity's business line for a set period of time. And public policy in the United States has been against those, because that forces someone to not work in their chosen profession. And so they have been largely replaced with garden leaves and notice provisions, which are essentially the same. And the effect of a garden leave or a notice provision is that you have to resign and continue to remain employed by your old firm. And the label garden leave comes from, they send you home to sit in your backyard, and you cannot work for the new firm, but you also cannot be in touch with your clients. The difference being, and the public policy reason that supports it, is you're still getting paid. so you don't fall behind on your bills and your mortgages and everything else. And so legislatures and judges don't take as dim a view of those because you're still getting paid, right? And so those have been almost universally enforced in the United States. The limitation on those is that the length of time has to have some rational basis to the need of the old employer to reassign accounts. And as you've probably seen, and as many market participants will see, the more junior you are, there'll be 30 days, mid-level folks are 60 days, higher level folks can be 90 days. But those present very difficult situations for financial advisors, because what happens at most firms is you give your notice and then the firm tells you to go home, and then your cell phone lights up and all your clients are calling you and asking you questions. And you're kind of in this limbo of you still work for your old firm. You can't talk to them about your new firm, and your clients who you feel you owe a fiduciary duty to are looking to you for advice. So anyone that's under a garden leave should be well advised by an attorney as to what they can and cannot say. Now, moving to your last restrictive covenant, which was a non-solicit agreement of clients, that concept has been litigated probably more than any other restrictive covenant in the United States. And you know, the definition of solicit in every firm's agreement is probably vastly broader than the law will allow that firm to enforce. And New York is a classic example of where the New York case law has advanced to the point which it would tell a firm that, you know, your definition of non-solicit is too broad, because it says that an advisor cannot even provide a courtesy announcement to a previous client to let him know where he is, and end it at that, and just say, you know, Mr. Client, I want to let you know here's where I'm at, and if you want to reach out to me, great, if not, fine, and then and end the call there. What happens in practice is most clients have deep-rooted, long-standing relationships with that advisor, and they'll follow that announcement with a series of their own questions. And many of those questions fit a pattern, like, well, what happens next? Or can I transfer my account to you? And things like that. And an advisor is always free to answer those questions truthfully and accurately. And, you know, FINRA, which has been involved in these disputes for decades, has really taken a position that the client's right to choose the financial advisor of their choice is paramount. And they're not saying that firms can't enforce a non-solicit, but what I think FINRA has come around to is clients are increasingly sophisticated. The internet's available. You can find your advisor on the CRD. You can find them on LinkedIn. You can find them almost anywhere just by putting their name in a Google search. And if a client reaches out to an advisor and says, how do I transfer my account to you? FINRA had to stop firms decades ago from seeking TROs that would stop ACATs. And they've issued regulatory notice after regulatory notice telling firms the clients have the right to move, the clients have the right to the financial advisor of their choice. Even to the point of most recently, there's a more recent regulatory notice that requires financial firms and reassigned advisors, if a customer asks where the new advisor has gone and what their contact information is, if the advisor who has resigned has provided that information in their resignation letter, the old firm has to provide that information to the customer. And that really signals, I think, a seismic shift in FINRA's thought that, hey, the customer needs this information. The customer shouldn't be left in the dark. The customer's interests are more paramount than a firm's interest in keeping these accounts. And advisors should know that in many instances, they can fully comply with their non-solicits and transition between firms with their clients making their own informed decisions to follow them quite successfully. And they can minimize the litigation risk if they do all this in the right way.
Got it. Last question that I think makes some sense for the line of the conversation here. You know, we've seen at times when protocol exits have been executed by large scale organizations that recruiting at large has dipped or come to a halt. or the potential valuation of the businesses associated with advisors at those firms that have exited have also been impacted. Your thoughts on if Merrill were to exit the protocol, you know, would there be a potential damage to be done to the valuation of those businesses and those teams in the short term? Is that something that at times you've seen as you've dealt with, you know, other protocol exit processes and teams that decided to transition during that exit itself or afterwards?
I think the short answer is yes. I think, again, the marketplace is going to evaluate every team a little bit based upon their individual factors. But I can tell you that having been in private practice for 21 years and having started my career in-house at brokerage firms and been involved in a lot of litigation, the threat of litigation has a chilling effect on all recruiting. So when any firm first leaves the protocol, there is a chilling effect on recruiting out of that firm, because the first thought of the national recruiting teams at other firms, branch managers, the attorneys, everyone is going to be, what is going to be happening? And we'll use Merrill Lynch as an example. If Merrill Lynch leaves the protocol, are they going to be very aggressive for the first 25 teams that leave and sue everyone? Are they, you know, what's going to happen? And then, so if you're the recruiting firm, are you going to have to put a budget together for representing your firm that's going to get sued and the advisors who are getting sued and going through that whole entire process? I would think that there will be a chilling effect for some time until a certain number of test cases have gone through and the marketplace can react. And, you know, I would say that the right after Morgan Stanley and UBS left, I think Morgan Stanley and UBS probably gave a few days leeway because they had left so abruptly. But after about a month or so, they were very aggressive. And so if the past performance of other large firms leaving is any indication of what the next firm might do, I do think there'll be a chilling effect. And when I say chilling effect, I think it would be both in the dollar amounts offered to those teams and also the nature of the packages, right? So, you know, one of the things that more sophisticated participants in this area will know is if you're coming out of a private bank, you're going to get a deal that's probably more back-ended than up-fronted because the receiving firm doesn't know how sticky your accounts are. If you had historically been coming out of a wirehouse, the wirehouses would were all treated the same in terms of the recruiting packages. So I think there'll be a chilling effect on overall recruiting and maybe a possible restructuring of the nature of the deals future Merrill Lynch transitioning teams might be offered.
Well, I think that's fantastic information, Brian, and exceptional value to those that will listen to your comments. It is, you know, it's only some level of legal sense that should firms have to, you know, create a budget to handle litigation that might ensue, that particular cost is going to be passed on somewhere. And so a deal will be, you know, reduced in some way based on what they may face from litigation costs. So that makes all the sense in the world. I think there's an enormous amount of pearls of wisdom in your commentary today. So we thank you for taking the time. It's been fantastic.
You're welcome, Andrew. I look forward to continuing conversations with your team.
You bet. Thanks, Brian.